Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or you could be like Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John, who all support the podcast on Patreon. If a monthly contribution isn't your thing, you can also support the podcast by purchasing a t-shirt, hoodie, sticker, or even a face mask featuring any of the 11 different podcast logo designs available on our Teespring store. Work or other current events can be pretty stressful at times, and a good way to relieve that stress is today's topic, recreational angling. Many people get into this field because of their experiences fishing as a child, and while we are chatting amongst ourselves, we realize that each of the different hosts likes to fish in a different way for a different species, so we thought we'd share some of our favorites with you today. And we'll get things started with the newly Idahoan, Brett. I think he likes to fish for trout, but I'm not entirely sure. Brett, what do you like to fish for?
Well, you definitely hit it on the head, which is not super surprising for someone living in Idaho. I definitely have a lot of opportunities, but as you mentioned in the intro, I definitely didn't start out that way, and I grew up fishing farm ponds, mostly the one that is on my grandparents' farm, just for your pretty typical bass, bluegill, and the occasional crappie. And it was a far cry from fly fishing, what I do now. Not saying that either one is better. They're just a definitely different environment and a different experience. But started fly fishing quite a bit in high school and college. And Clemson actually had a fly fishing club that I was involved with pretty closely. We took annual fishing trips that Trout Unlimited and Costa Del Mar put on every year, and those were super fun. But started trout fishing a lot, and that kind of molded what I like to do for work in a way, because I really started liking stream and river environments, and particularly cold water fisheries, and just anything that flows through mountains and hills kind of excited me. But since I've been out here, most recently I took my first trip to a National Wild and Scenic River, the St. Joe, and I was able to angle my first cutthroat trout, specifically a West Slope cutthroat, if it matters. It doesn't, but that was my first experience going for cutthroat trout, which is our state fish, so that was kind of cool. And then, yeah, that's pretty much what I've been up to recently. And I guess without talking too much about it, I typically fly fish for those species in those environments like rivers and streams. But definitely the best way that I figured out how to cast was actually catching bluegills on little poppers and small ponds. That's the best way that I found to teach myself how to fly cast pretty well. So
when you were working on your master's, you had a fair bit of time in the Driftless region, but when you were back in Ames, did you ever fly fish for any of those Skunk River smallmouth?
That's a great question, actually. Yeah, I did fish around the Skunk River and a couple of the small ponds that are in and around Ames. But right before I moved, actually, I caught a 13.5-inch smallmouth bass on a small little streamer on my 4-weight fly rod. So it's definitely not by any stretch a huge smallmouth, but it was really fun. And that was actually right before I moved. That was a pretty cool day because I caught a white crappie in the Skunk River in an area that I wouldn't really associate with their habitat. So that was pretty cool. That was a good day.
And do you tie your own flies, or do you just go to the fly shop and stock up on them?
Yeah, I still go to the fly shop occasionally to buy a couple of things because I'm definitely no master, but I actually recently have started tying my own flies. Primarily nymphs or just like smaller subsurface flies that you sort of drift along. And then here recently, this week, actually, I've been tying up a bunch of woolly buggers for anyone in the fly fishing world, that's kind of a pretty universal pattern or a lure, if you will. But yeah, it's definitely my winter goal is to fill all my fly boxes and spend some time behind the vise, because I'm by no means a professional, but it's just really something fun to do after a crappy day or during times where the days are short and, you know, you get home from work and it's already dark outside. So it's good evening activity. I've had a lot of fun with it.
Is it like rewarding catching fish off the flies you've tied?
Oh yeah, for sure. The first trout I caught on something that I tied, I was actually surprised, because I was like, oh wow, I was actually able to fool a rather picky, well, they're known to be picky in certain places, but brown trout can be sort of fabled as harder trout species to trick sometimes. So when I caught my first brown trout on something that I tied, I was pretty proud, that's for sure. Especially since I don't catch a lot of fish. Even when I go fishing on like long days, I don't catch a lot of fish, never have. And I don't know if it's because I'm just bad or that's just how it is, but I think it might have something to do with me just watching the stream sometimes. I'll kind of just like kick back on a boulder and just like watch stuff and then realize that I haven't done anything for the past 30 minutes besides watch the stream. But I prefer it that way. I've never been a super competitive fisherman, which works out because I'd be bad at it.
When you're fishing, are you able to see the fish? Like, is it more sight fishing, or is it kind of like you go through the motions or like the concept of a fly fishing cast to, and then like hoping a fish is around, I guess?
That's such a good question. Yeah, primarily when I'm fishing like smaller rivers and, you know, medium streams and stuff, it, like you said, you can't really see. I mean, even with polarized sunglasses, like a lot of these streams, especially if they're on an off color day after some precipitation or something, you can't really see the fish. It's kind of, you'll hear the phrase like reading the water quite a bit. So you kind of just like choose habitats where, you know, you would expect those species to sort of hang out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm sure it's similar with stuff that you guys do, especially if you're fishing, you know, deeper down in reservoirs or something. You know, you can't always, you're not, you know, sight casting for some of those species, you know, in smaller streams where the pools are tiny and it's a crystal clear day. Yeah. I mean, I've tried sight casting at trout, but they're super spooky. I've had more success doing that with like bluegills in really shallow habitat. Those are kind of like, oh yeah, there's a pod hanging out over by this little grassy area. I'm just gonna put something on top of the water and they'll probably smash it.
Yeah. Awesome.
Have any of you guys fly fish before or make your own lures or anything like that?
I never have, but it is something that I would like to pick up in the future. It seems like a lot of fun. So I guess since you've asked that, if I were to, I guess, pick up fly fishing within, I don't know, next season, what would be the biggest learning curve for me when it comes to fly fishing?
Oh, definitely. I think for me, the biggest thing is, well, I guess two, is that the patience of like throwing your line instead of a lure, it's definitely different. You have to sort of wait until the rod is, I guess, what they call loaded. So sometimes I think a lot of people early on are sort of, and myself included, are sort of guilty sometimes about going through the motions a little bit too fast of casting, because they're used to just maybe just like whipping back and trying to cast as far as possible or as hard as possible. But there's like some patience to the motion of the rod itself. And then two, I guess I already said it, but just transitioning from throwing the line to where the end result is your lure ending up somewhere, then like picking a spot and chunking your lure to that spot. So that, I think those are two big things. Having said that, Orvis puts out tons of videos on like different types of casting and things like that. And I won't talk about this too much because you're going to have a popular segment coming up later in the episode, but Tom Rosenbauer, who is with Orvis, has some epic videos of him fly fishing from everything from like blue marlin all the way to some huge carp. So definitely check out Tom Rosenbauer's videos.
Okay. I think I've heard too.
Yeah, he's like a legend in fly fishing and probably trout conservation or whatever. But yeah, he's got, that dude is amazing fisherman, unlike myself.
Awesome. Well, thanks for letting me know, Brett.
Yeah,
I've tried fly fishing before, maybe like 6 years ago. The first time I went out to Yellowstone, or the second time I went out to Yellowstone, I told myself, oh, I want to go try a trout fish while I'm out there. So I bought a fly rod when I was in Missouri before I left, and I even bought like a kit from Bass Pro to tie my own trout flies and tied up a few. They're probably terrible as far as trout flies go, but they looked good to me. And went out there and fished a few different spots, but never got anything. Still stuck, kept the pole, and I was using it later that summer or the next year at my family farm. We have a pond out there, and messed up in my back cast. So I was like sitting there messing with the reel, trying to fix something, and got, when I got it fixed, I went to swing it forward again and had a crappie on the end of it. So that was the only fish I've ever caught on a fly rod, was just messing with the line.
Dang, that's awesome. Don't worry, I've caught trout like that where like I just put my fly in the water to let out more line, and you know, just got extremely lucky and was like, oh yeah, that, I did that.
This might be good for me to jump in with my fly fishing adventures. I used to fly fish in more western cold streams, and then even in Wisconsin in colder streams. But down here in Arkansas, I've started fly fishing again, but more so what I call micro fly fishing, because I'm basically fly fishing with the smallest fly rod that we have, and then the smallest flies that we have. And I'm fishing for things like long-ear sunfish. And so that's pretty fun. And I would say, Deanne, what I think can be the difficult part of fly fishing is sometimes it can be kind of intimidating to get into it.
Yeah.
And so I think you just have to go for it and not worry as much about like, you know, exactly how people even tell you how to do it, because you're going to find your own style.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of sidecast a little bit, but that kind of depends on, you know, how much vegetation and bushes you have on shore and things like that. But fly fishing is just so much fun, because sometimes you do start, instead of just trying to get the fish, like you are just testing yourself to see if you can get your fly in exactly a certain spot on the water.
Yeah. And yeah.
That can be really fun. Sometimes I actually fish with no hook. And so I'm just trying to put that fly in exactly the right spot with no weight. And that can be really difficult, especially with no hook on it.
Mm-hmm. So is that like, are you emphasized on getting your fly in the right spot? Is that critical? Like, is the fly presentation critical to like getting a fish to bite?
I think it certainly can be, especially like Brett was saying, trout are so, they're so easily spooked.
Yeah.
So I think it depends on the species. But some are rather curious. Sometimes little schools of minnows and things like that will find that to be curious when the fly just kind of plunks down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it really depends on what you're fishing for.
Gotcha.
But some people kind of try to put it down and then have it drift into where their fish is. So it's kind of more of a natural presentation.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I'm fishing for a lot of little tiny sunfish right now, but I also have a little, some people call them photarium. Like I call mine a viewing window. And so I take a lot of pictures of my fish after I catch it in that little clear plastic box. And then of course I release it. But that's just kind of the version of fishing that I find really enjoyable in these kind of clear Arkansas streams and rivers.
Yeah. That sounds like a lot of fun for sure. It's always, I've always enjoyed, I mean, obviously I'm from Ohio, so we don't have mountains and we typically don't have, especially Lake Erie, clear water. So it is very enjoyable seeing streams like that and just being able to see fish swim around in them and able to just observe them in their habitat.
Yeah. And I can definitely totally attest to what Sue said about like technique and it being intimidating, because it is kind of like uppity and elitist, or like some folks can be in the, I don't want to call it a sport, but in the, you know, activity or the community, whatever. But I watch videos and I just kind of, like Sue said, just like have my own style of doing things. And it's probably not technically correct or super pretty, but it kind of just like works for me. So I never have been super, I'm like self-taught everything. And so if it's a little uglier than textbook, I always am like, whatever, that's fine. That's fine by me because I'm having fun. But that's really cool, Sue, that you are fishing for, you know, different species and what people would think of as like game species. I remember like you said, it's like micro fishing, but you're kind of fly fishing. So it's not like the like true micro fishing gear that they have now. It's super specialized, but I was catching war paint shiners on just tiny, tiny hooks and little, I don't even remember what I was using as bait. It wasn't, you know, flies or anything, but I was just using tiny bits of bait and catching war paint shiners, and that was really cool. I had a bunch of fun with that, and actually a great viewer on a budget for small species are those plastic containers that have the chewing gum in them. They have like five or so, like what would be packs of chewing gum. I know this is super random, but it's like $3 at a gas station, and once you chew all the gum, because I chew a lot of gum, those are amazing viewers for small species. Just a tip for anyone out there that likes to look at little fish like I do.
That is awesome. That's a great tip. Yeah, it'll be cool, Dion. Do give it a try and then let us know how you feel about it. My favorite part is like looking back behind me and watching the line like feed out.
Okay.
And then bringing it back forward. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But if fishing is your thing because you really immerse yourself in it, I find that it's an easy style to get truly immersed in because you're in kind of complete control of where that line goes. And you're really responsible for it staying in the air and then going right where you want it to go in the water. And so, yeah, give it a try. It'd be really cool to see how you like it and to see what you find in Clemson.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to give it a try and get a little setup to just kind of get myself going. I have a friend who's always asking me to, he's always messaging me, do you get a fly rod yet? And I've never gotten around to it, so I really need to do that.
Yeah, Eli Lamb and Hank Hershey catch some amazing native black bass species on the fly. I see all their pictures on Twitter and stuff, and they fish in some pretty, I guess, blue line places, and they catch some really cool looking native bass species. So I don't know how far, I mean, I guess Alabama's, you know, decently far from Clemson, but you know, Eli's a Clemson grad, and I'm sure if they're ever in that area, that'd be a super good bunch to learn from and go with.
Yeah. You'd have to, if you can, you can shoot me their contact info potentially.
Yeah. Oops. They might not go with you unless you let them know how to fish for carp though.
So. Secrets for secrets, right?
I'm So you guys want to talk about carp? So we can talk about it.
Yeah, so should we get Julie and Nick in quick, and then we just got to spend the rest of the time talking about carp because that's what we want to hear about. Julie, are you fly fishing?
I don't think I need to add anything.
Are you sure?
Okay. I could probably just go.
Can't miss it. Nick, did you want to talk about fly fishing for crappie?
Well, I've only ever caught one, so I've exhausted all my fly fishing for crappie stories, but...
It was a good one.
Yeah, I mean, it was successful.
There you go.
No, I mean, I just jig for crappie now. A 10-foot rod, just like a long rod, just like some of the fly rods, but instead of whipping the fly back and forth and letting it sit and drift, I just let out 10 feet of line, let my jig hit the bottom every once in a while, jig it up and down, and if I'm lucky, I find some crappie. So, nice. Not very exciting until you get a bite, and then it's pretty great. But
so, besides the crappie fishing, is there anything in particular that you typically target, Nick, or your sort of your favorite type of fishing? I know paddlefish is your favorite fish, but you know, I don't know what your favorite thing to fish for is. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I've gone snagging for paddlefish a few times, once in Oklahoma, once down at Table Rock, and both times was unsuccessful. At Table Rock, I snagged two giant long-nosed gar. I think we were just too late in the season, and the paddlefish had already moved on from where we were fishing at least. But so that's something I'd like to go back and do another time. Probably head over to Harry S. Truman over in Missouri and give it another go, or some of the rivers in southeast Kansas that feed into Grand Lake down in Oklahoma. They have some pretty good snag fisheries in some of the dams that we have in Kansas. So I want to try that some more, but I grew up bass fishing. Not quite as into it anymore, but I really want to get into blue cat fishing because that's kind of a growing thing in Kansas. Is our blue cat fisheries are getting big, and I mean, those fish can get pretty big. So hooking into a big, at least 40-pound blue cat would be fun. My reservoir hasn't quite developed a population yet, so I'd have to drive about an hour and a half over to Milford Reservoir, where they have a pretty good population. And that's pretty much been the only reason I haven't gone over and hooked into one yet. It's just the hour and a half drive, but that's something I'm definitely looking forward to trying next summer.
Do you eat those crappie, Nick?
Oh, yeah. I got a freezer full of crappie right now.
Okay, yeah. Sounds like you're going after a lot of edible fish there.
When you say snag fisheries, so like you are for paddlefish, the way of catching them or the style of catching them is simply by snagging and not like getting a bite?
Nope. So since they're planktivores, they don't really hit a lure or anything. Occasionally you'll hear stories of somebody catching one in the mouth and being accepted as a record. That was how the previous world record caught in Kansas ran through, because it was caught in the mouth with doe bait. But typically you're just slinging out like 1 pound, 2 pounds of lead and just swinging that pole back and forth if you're on shore, and just hoping to snag into one. And when you do it, I guess I haven't hooked into one, but the few gar I have, it's like hitting a brick wall and then fighting that thing. I mean, if you hook it sideways, that's a big mass of fish that you gotta reel in perpendicular to their body. So it's a pretty tiring adventure, that's for sure. Just casting out and reeling it in is pretty tiring. I can't imagine hooking into a big 150-pound fish like the world record was.
That sounds exhausting. Yeah. I'm like, ooh, yeah, 14-inch trout.
From boat, it's a little bit easier. Some of the guys will run dipsy divers and troll around for them. That's what they do in the winter months on some of those reservoirs down in Oklahoma. They run dipsy divers and troll around down near the dams where they're more concentrated in the winter. But in the spring, you're snagging the upriver locations like near Lowhead dams.
So have you done much blue cat fishing elsewhere? That was like my grandfather's bread and butter. When he was sort of there, when I was growing up, he was really big into striper fishing and blue catfish fishing. Those are his two favorite things. There's some pretty really large reservoirs, and I guess I'm not exactly familiar with the regions of South Carolina as I used to be, but basically Lake Marion and Moultrie, he would always fish those areas and do pretty well for both those species.
I've gone over to Milford a couple times in the spring. In the spring there, you can fish from shore and get them pretty easily, but I didn't have any luck. My coworkers fishing right alongside me did, but not me. But when I was in grad school on the Mississippi River, one of the guys I went to grad school with, we'd go out on the river and anchor up behind a dike and try to fish for them. And I had more luck sitting on shore, like near one of the boat ramps fishing, than when we went out behind one of the dikes. But he always did pretty good. But we never hooked into any of the monsters that you see some of the guys pull out of the rivers.
Right.
But when we were running gill nets, we had a handful of fish like over 50 pounds, and a couple of them were over 70. So there were some big fish in some of these areas we were fishing, but I mean, those things, river fish move so much that they were probably there just for the day that we caught them.
Right. And I guess it wouldn't be a science related podcast if I didn't ask, are the blue catfish native to that system? Because I know some people that are listening to this might have adverse feelings about blue catfish, depending on where they live in the United States.
Yeah, so blue catfish they're native to the Missouri River drainage, and some of the tributaries of the Missouri River run through Kansas, namely the Kansas River. Covers kind of the northeastern third of the state. And so they were native there, and I'm not 100% confident in my ability to recite the history of blue catfish in Kansas, but at one point there was consideration to list blue catfish as a species in need of conservation, a sink species. But then we began reintroducing them into first Milford Reservoir, and then eventually 20 different reservoirs across the state, I think. And the numbers have bounced back up to the point where there's was some talk this year of opening up our stream regulations to allow more harvest of these fish. But so they've definitely bounced back and very, very abundant in some of our reservoirs and rivers, especially downstream of those reservoirs where they're stocked.
Nice. Yeah, I figured they probably were, since you're, in that area of the country. But as I mentioned before, it's a popular fishery in the Southeast, but not necessarily where they're supposed to be in all those systems. So some people love to fish for them, but some people also hate their guts. So.
And speaking of a fish that isn't where it's supposed to be and some people hate their guts, Dion fishes for a fish that many regard as trash fish, but is growing in popularity. There's even an avid group of anglers in Kansas that comment on our agency Facebook page about fishing for common carp. And it's kind of a unique target because most people don't really go for them. They're not a widespread edible food, but Dion, you seem to enjoy fishing for them.
So yeah, for the most part, everybody hates common carp. It's usually if you're in fisheries. I mean, I always get a lot of flack for it. But as far as fishing for them, there's a lot to talk about. I guess I'll kind of ask, is there anything specific you would like to know? Or like, do you want to know about, I guess, how I got into it?
Yeah. How did you get into it? And then what would be really cool is like, what's a day in the life of a carp fisher person? Like, like how does one get up and go carp fishing? I think.
How I got into carp fishing. I'll take myself way back here. So when I first started fishing, I was catching bullheads at East Harbor State Park, which is a state park located in Marblehead, Ohio. So it's not far from Sandusky, but it was, I believe, early June or so. And the carp were pretty much spawning, and it's very visual to anybody fishing when common carp are spawning. Like it's very noticeable. You'll see them splashing and practically on the bank, reproducing. And people will try to catch them and it just won't work. But in general, I was seeing these fish spawn when I was little, and I just couldn't help to find a fascination in them for some reason, maybe because they were just so big for a little 8-year-old me. And I mean, they really weren't that big at the time. But yeah, so I've always had an interest in carp from just from that experience when I was real little and just starting to fish for the first time in my life. And then as I grew older, I learned that I could catch carp with bread. And I figured this out one day. I was at my grandpa's apartment complex, and they had a small little pond, and I had some worms with me. So I went to just fish off the bottom and see what I could catch there. But I was actually eating some food, and I tossed the bread that I had left over from my sandwich in the water. And I was walking around the pond, and I came back and seen carp were eating the bread that I just threw in like a few minutes after I had tossed it in. So I was like, oh my gosh. So I ran back and grabbed a loaf of bread and then just ripped up a couple of pieces, and I would float them on the surface. And similarly to what you guys are saying about trout is that carp are pretty spooky fish too. They're timid at some point. So I would throw this bread in, and if they seen you like get too close to the water, they would just dart off, and then you pretty much lost your chance. And so you kind of have to be real sneaky, trying to get up to like back up to the bank while they're feeding. And eventually, yeah, you just simple as putting a piece of bread on your line and sneaking it in there, and then it's your adrenaline just starts rushing when you see one of the bigger fish in that group or just a fish going up to your bread, and you know it's about to suck it up and the fight's about to be on. So that's very addicting and a lot of fun. And in terms of carp fishing, you can actually kind of categorize that style as a stalking, which is a common term used in Europe. So then I can also add now, in Europe, carp fishing or sport fishing for common carp is very popular there. So that I always like to say it's like bass fishing in America. That's basically the equivalent. So they'll use the term for stalking, and basically if you have clear waters, or sometimes you can see carp basking in the sun on the water's cold, if the sun's out, you can see them and you can track them down and try and throw bait in the water and get them to bite. And those kinds of things are that style for carp fishing is, I don't know, it's definitely rewarding, but you won't just catch a bunch of fish in a day, that's for sure. But moving into the whole European style of carp fishing, there's definitely a lot to take in. And I got into the European style one day when I was downtown Sandusky. So right on Sandusky Bay shoreline, there was a fish in held in there. So there's a Ohio Carp Anglers group. And then there's a big national group for the country called the Carp Anglers group. And I ran into a couple friends who I knew what they were doing. They had like their pod or rod pods and their alarms and these big 12, 13 foot rods sitting on them. And so I just walked up to them. I was just like, hey, are you guys carp fishing? And they was like, yeah, how'd you know? And I was just like, well, I've seen some of it on YouTube. And so eventually they basically showed me the most basic setup for like that style. So fishing off the bottom. And it was a hair rig. So like this hair rig, you can just picture a traditional fishing hook with nothing on it. And the way you tie the rig up is you'll have a loop that hangs off the back of that hook. And you have this, here. Yeah, you can picture a like a crocheting needle from like Joann Fabrics. We call them bait needles, and they're like specially made for this purpose, but they have a little hook on them. So you can grab this loop and slide like pieces of corn or other types of carp baits onto this rig. And the purpose of this hair rig is the carp will suck the corn or whatever you got on it that's being used as bait. They'll suck that up and the hook will go with it, but they'll never swallow the hook because they'll detect it as soon as they suck it up. So they go to spit it out and it hooks the bottom of their lip every time. And as soon as they feel that prick, they just take off. And that's when like your alarms, if you got them, will take off, or in general, your drag will just start peeling. So I guess that's really addicting when it comes to carp fishing. So I guess I can kind of walk you through an average day for a carp fisherman. So for myself, I like to prepare a spot typically before I go fishing. So we call it pre-baiting. And we will essentially, or all pre-baiting is you're putting bait into the water before you fish it. And it's, you're chumming the water, for, I guess, simpler terms. And that's just really to bring the fish around. And it's an effective tactic on a water that you've never fished before. So typically when I had my old job and I really didn't have time, I would work like late nights. I would have my bait ready. So I actually would go to Tractor Supply and buy like 50 pound bags of feed corn. And you can just boil that corn for like an hour or two, and then it gets soft, which then it's like safe to digest. And you can go ahead and I'll boil a 5 gallon bucket of that, and I'll make one like each day and just dump that in. And if you want to get real premium for them, you can mix in like sweet feed too, which you can also purchase from Tractor Supply. So I'll buy like a 30 pound bag or a 50 pound bag of sweet feed and mix that in. But yeah, you pretty much just dump this piles of corn in the water, or you can buy this piece of tackle called a spom. So you can load your corn up in that and cast it out too. So if you're fishing that range, you can bait up a spot that's way out by just casting the chum out. It takes time and effort and practice because you want to be precise, but it's a very effective tool for sure. But so come the day you're gonna go fishing, you should have all your carp chummed in and on your bait, and it typically doesn't take long for a bite. And I should talk about the bait that goes into it too. So not only do you have, like, you don't have to, but not only did I pre-bait the water, but you get this, when I actually fish, I'll buy two big cans of oats. So like old fashioned oats, or you can use quick oats too. It doesn't matter, but you can buy oats and mix it with cream corn and whole kernel corn to make a pack bait, we call it. And you actually can pack that like ball of oats that you got around your lead. And then like with your corn on your hair rig, you can just stick that in the ball and cast it out. And the pack ball just break down in the water. So that's just free for the carp to eat. But then your hook bait is in that pile. And that's pretty much the typical, I guess, European style way. There's like a lot more to it. But as far as very basic, I would say that's as basic as you can get. Is there any anything you guys are curious about or want me to specifically touch on more?
I know that's basic for you, but that sounds like a lot of work.
It's a lot. It really is. And I would love to just like show a video or like make a quick video just so you can visually see it all. And you're like, oh, okay. Okay. I guess I should add too, cause this is actually the most important thing. If you're getting into the European style of it, is their fish there are, they are bred. Okay. European lakes are typically pay lakes, but their lakes are managed a lot different than how a pay lake is in America. Cause typically pay lakes have bad reps here because they're basically giant fish bowls with no natural food sources whatsoever and bad management. I mean, and like the stocking is poor, which is, you know, not going to be true for all, but from a lot of the pay lakes I've seen, that's typically how it is. But in the UK or in France or Germany, their lakes are stocked with very expensive fish. So they actually selectively breed for the biggest carp, I guess, big carp genes, or specific designs. So like mirror carp are essentially a subspecies of common carp, but they just have a different scale pattern. So they have like really large scales and can have typically have fewer scales than how a common carp looks. And they can come with like cool designs, like a linear look with the scales. And essentially though, they will breed for these fish, or they'll selectively breed for a fish to look like that. And then they stock them in their waters. But the management on the waters is very, I guess, high end. And typically those, like the waters you're paying to fish on, have good natural resources. They basically have, they're completely opposite of essentially an American pay lake. So with that being said, because these fish are expensive and because they are not being, caught to be harvested, they're, the biggest thing with carp fishing, is carp care, which this is where a lot of people really like to laugh at carp anglers. So like I actually have a carp cradle. So when I catch the fish, instead of laying them on the rocks or like on the concrete or something like that, I can lay them in my cradle where they don't get beat up and all trashed while I'm trying to handle it on land, which is similar to the trout fishing where you guys put them in the clear containers to look at them. And I like that a lot, because this habit that has come from carp fishing for like caring for the fish has kind of grown on me for all species I fish for now. So I really like to take care of whatever I catch and handle it safely on land. So that, I think that was a really good habit I picked up. But additionally too, we like to take pictures of our fish. So if we catch a cool koi or a really big fish, or it has a unique scale pattern on it, you never know what you'll get. But taking pictures is always a must. So typically when pictures are taken, we'll get down on our knees or just squat down, because again, carp care, we like to keep the fish close to the ground or close to the cradle or mat, just in case if it were to flop, we would like to, and if we were to drop it, it would at least fall in the mat, or if it were to hit the ground, it wasn't a very high drop it had to suffer from. So that's like most important is the carp care for sure.
Well, that's cool, DM, because that was my question, was like, what do you do with it when you catch one? Because when you catch a carp, like boat electroshocking, it's pretty difficult to manage it once it gets on the boat.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, so what you're saying is this carp cradle is how people deal with that. Do you have to wear special gloves or anything like that?
No gloves, but if you want to be real into, I guess, the care portion, I know in the UK it's more common, but in America I don't find it a big deal. Most American anglers, like, we're not, there's definitely some differences between like American anglers that try to mimic the European style of it, and one of those things is like medicine, I guess, so or like hook wound medicine. So it's very common in a UK tackle shop to buy a hook wound medicine. So it's basically like a I'm trying to think of it's kind of like Neosporin. It reminds me of it, I guess. So you'll catch a fish and they'll, or some people in America too, you know, they'll take this cream or whatever it is, ointment, and they'll rub it on the hook wound of the fish, or if it maybe loses a scale on the fight coming in, or like when you're handling it in the net or so, it loses a scale or something, they'll rub this ointment on those wounds to aid in the fish recovery. So yeah, handling them on land is, it can definitely, I definitely understand when you're in a fisheries environment and you pull them up in a net or you're electrofishing them, it can definitely be difficult. But fishing wise, there is a process to it. Like keeping everything kind of neat and well under control, because they can be powerful fish and very spontaneous and when they're going to try and flop out of your hands.
That is next level fish care. That's awesome. That's crazy.
It's pretty crazy. I'm telling you, like, when people are like, they'll look at my setup and they'll go, well, they'll see it's like a big green basket, essentially. Mm-hmm. Obviously it's cloth, but, and they'll be like, well, what's that? Is that where you keep your fish? I'm like, oh no, that's my carp cradle. And they'll just laugh. And they're like, you have a cradle for carp? And then usually the comment comes after that where it's just like, yeah, well, when I use fish for carp, I just shoot them with a bow. And it's like, well, you know,
that's how you do it, not how I do it.
Or enemy.
I've seen people use cradles for like big steelhead and stuff. So I definitely know that sentiment of trying to, you know, keep your hands off the fish and
preserve a trophy fish. Mm-hmm. I think musky fishermen use similar thing, like a sling too. Like, I do have a sling. It's like the sling is used for like weighing, and it helps with safe releasing too. So I can carry the fish back in the sling and then just open it up in the water. But yeah, I don't know if there's any way I can make a quick video or something too, if you guys are interested, if you want to like visually see it, you know, I would be more than happy to do something like that too.
Yeah, Dion, I've been in a panic over here, like searching everything you're talking about. So I have, it took me a long time to find this carp care wound treatment medicine like that.
Yeah.
That was difficult to find, but I did
pretty much got to type in .uk or .eu on like your link, because you're just not going to find anything. I mean, that's another struggle, I guess, that like doing this in America, you have to go through, is just getting simple tackle like hooks or specific lead. Leads aren't too big of a deal, but hooks, rods, reels, cradles, slings, all that, you pretty much got to order it online, because it's not stocked in American stores.
Yeah, I found it on houseofcarp.com, which looks like it's like a UK site.
Yeah, if you some good YouTube channels to check out for all the listeners and for you guys as well, it would be like Corda Tackle, Nash Tackle. Like, those are some big brand names. Some like bait names would be like Mainline Baits, CC Moore. Like these are all just brands, but they're well-known brands, and there's many more, or there's a lot more. But I think like starting with like Korda, and then like checking out like their Thinking Tackle videos or so. Those are good videos to start, just to kind of get an idea on how it all goes down, or what it's all about.
I've looked into carp fishing a little bit, just because those vocal anglers on our Facebook page have got me interested in it, and I found Catfish and Carp has some really great videos on at least.
Oh yeah, on getting started. Yeah. You talking about Luke from Cats and Carp?
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good dude. I used to watch a lot of his videos. He's definitely a really good like beginner guy to watch, because he shows all the basics, and it's simple. Like I said, it's a lot to take in, and even the people that walk up to me, and because you, when you have the full setup, like you will get a lot of like public or publicity, I guess, or people coming up to you and asking questions. And even then it's just a lot for them to take in, but it's really fascinating just to see them enjoy pretty much like how you do it and what's going on. So
it definitely sounds like something you can't just like do on a whim. You know, like it's a Thursday afternoon and you get off work early and you're like, I'm just going to go carp fishing. You're like, definitely sounds like you got to put your time into the pre-trip, I guess.
I'm glad you said that, because that's very true. So I definitely have found myself fishing a bit less this year, just because it does – I found myself fishing less for carp this year and a little bit more for bass or panfish, just because, like you said, minimum when I go out doing this, it's like 4 hours at minimum, or, you know, and I mean, that's a commitment of time at some point. And like a full day is 8 to 24 hours or more. Like we'll camp out all night. It is a lot of commitment. It's a lot of gear to set up and to transport around, which, you know, that could be overwhelming, but it's not that scary, but it is a commitment though. That is for sure.
Yeah. Tying back into something you said earlier, it really does sound more like hunting than it does fishing. Not to like take away from the experience, because obviously it's fishing, but when you said earlier that, you know, that process that you were describing is called like stalking, you know, you can see a lot of parallels to how you would prepare for a hunt, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And it's very rewarding too, just like hunting at some point, you know, soon you can get the fish going on like your bread on the surface, or maybe you threw in a bottom bait, but the water's clear and you can see the bottom. It is very rewarding to get a bite and to see it happen.
So Dion, if you release the fish, can you catch the same fish? Have you done that yet?
I want to say I have, but I honestly think typically you get like one chance unless you're in a pond. I would say the odds of it happening again is not that high, or are not that high.
But are they relatively long lived?
I think so. I think I read like the average age for a carp is like in the high teens or higher or something like that.
Yeah.
I know they're hardy fish, but I really learned that working in a tech job, because you don't have time for carp care when you're trying to net fish and get them in a live well or something like that. But you just kind of find out that they can, or during like doing gill netting and things like that, you just learn that those fish are pretty hardy.
Are they pretty smart? Do they learn?
I would say so. And I do have a publication on fish behaviors, and it specifically was focusing on common carp learning behaviors and the influences by anglers. Or so it was like the proper behavioral response in a dangerous situation. And the paper focused on common carp and basically getting hooked and like what is the response they I guess show, and then how it affects them in schools, I guess. It's a good paper. But I would definitely say they're smart, especially so like I guess to add to that too, outside of that paper, there's in Europe, a lot of their fish are pressured. So, or I guess they're fished for, they're not in big open waters, like kind of how American waters are, or at least how Lake Erie is. So these fish are pressured a lot, and they oftentimes, if you watch some of these tackle companies who, you know, have their YouTube channels that like fishing for them, they often talk about basically keeping the bait as subtle as possible, or the equipment as subtle as possible, because the fish essentially can see that it's probably like a hook bait in the pile of chum that they have out there. And even on some of the underwater cameras, you can see them go up to it and they'll shy away from like the hook bait, but then feed directly around it the whole time.
That's awesome. So do you fish with other folks when you go out, or like, are you part of any Facebook groups or potentially online forums that you've met some people to go fish with or anything like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm actually really glad you asked that question. So there's, as I mentioned earlier briefly, there's the like national group for America called the Carp Anglers Group, or CAG, if you want to pronounce the acronym. That's CAG. You can find it on Facebook if you're interested. But then those groups are kind of broken up into subgroups. So we do have an Ohio Carp Anglers group, and it is ran through like the Carp Anglers Society. So there is like a chair for each group. And one of the coolest things that I love about being in that group is we will host fish-ins. So we basically schedule throughout the primary fishing season, which is April through October. I think we maybe do one in November, but we kind of do a vote. But basically it's just a venue for the weekend each month. So I know like Huron River is one of the places, that's a place where I typically fish because it's local to me. But that's a place we'll meet up in the fall. So like September, we'll do our fish in there. So it'll be like 10 to 20 people that show up with their tents and all of their carp gear. And we're just lined up along the pier, and they'll start from Friday at noon run, and they'll run all the way to Sunday at noon. So we'll camp out basically all weekend, and it's just a good time. Everyone's just out fishing for carp, doing the same thing you're doing, and socializing. We'll grill out, and we get to teach people that come up and ask us about it. So yeah, there's definitely some groups you can look into, and some socializing as well.
That's really cool, because I think especially for something that, like you said, has a little bit of a learning curve, if someone were to see one of those YouTube videos or listen to this podcast and be super interested and want to try it, it's always nice to like have that sense of place or community. And so it's good to know that there's some resources out there, even though it's not the most popular fish to fish for. around here that some folks can find some stuff. And hopefully when you get down to Lake Hartwell or potentially the surrounding area, there'll be some folks at or around Clemson that are the same way and sort of fish hard for carp in that area. So you won't be too longing for it once you get to South Carolina.
Yeah, I know. I can't wait to catch my first South Carolina carp, and being so close to Lake Hartwell, as long as I have the free time, I will definitely put it in to try and get one. I know Nick was talking I know Nick was talking about blue cats earlier, and I know Aaron had told me that Lake Hartwell also has blue cats, so I might use my second rod. Is it a three rod limit in South Carolina? I'm not sure.
Ooh, I don't remember, actually. That's a good question. I don't remember.
I know the blue cat's on my list too, but the common carp is there for sure. So I'm excited to get after it. That's like a lot of fun, is going to a lake you've never fished before and baiting it up, or just applying the knowledge and experience you have doing this and seeing what results you can get. You know, you could get, might jump on some 30-pound fish or some small ones, but it's always rewarding in the end.
Yeah, that's cool. Just make sure you don't get yelled at by somebody because they're trying to accuse you of baiting ducks or something.
Trust me, I don't even personally want ducks to come around, because they will definitely eat corn off the bottom if they can get to it.
How many do you usually catch in a day, Dion? Like, what's a good day?
So here on river, the local spot I was talking about earlier, it's not uncommon to catch 20 or more there. that river is just loaded with them. I mean, it's loaded with everything, but it just seems like there's so many passerbys, or just a constant new population of fish that moves in on the bait over time. So I would say you can have, like, I've had days like that where you catch 20 or more. But personally, I think that's very uncommon. So, like, a good day in a water that's not like that, as big as the river or, like, Lake Erie, a good day, in my opinion, is, like, 4 or 5. That's a really good day.
Wow.
Especially if you got, like, maybe a 20 or a 30-pound fish in there. I mean, especially a 30, that's – you just don't catch 30s very often. At least I don't, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a lot larger than what I'm going for. That's for sure.
Well, I mean, and I think that's a big part of the attraction too, is if you're into trying to catch, or if you're into catching hard fighting fish, then I would definitely say carp fishing would be a good hobby to pick up then, or a good fish to target.
Nick's probably ordering some carp cradles right now and getting geared up over there.
Yeah.
Well, I have tried carp fishing before. I went out late July or August. I went fishing for one of my lakes that I managed that pretty much only has carp in it, and managed to hook into a few. But I did the canned corn with breadcrumbs and Jell-O. Strawberry Jell-O mixture pack bait.
Yep. Yeah.
Watched a video on how to tie a hair rig the night before, and
yeah. See, and it is very, as much as there is a lot to take in, just Nick's simple statement right there just kind of shows how simple it is. You know, they can be very difficult fish, but honestly, they're pretty simple. I just don't think people realize that.
Hey, I put in a request to join the carp anglers group, so I hope to follow along on the journey. But it works for me to fish in little streams, and not like wrestle a 30-pound carp. But it's Yeah, it sounds great. I mean, when I'm out with my family, so I usually have little kids swimming at my feet, and so I can't do that in a big carp water. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, it sounds really fascinating. We'll have to, the video of you carp fishing is a must have, I think.
Okay, I would be more than happy to do that. And I can like kind of narrate things that way you know, you're still not asking questions. I wish I could take all of you out. I mean, I know I've had plenty of friends who I guess are near me in real life I've taken out, and it's worth it. It really, it's worth the experience, and to just, I guess, see how it's done firsthand.
Well, there should be a good amount of time left, hopefully, in life, Deanne. And so hopefully we can get that together. We might be able to get all out carp fishing in a meeting sometime.
Yeah. Yeah. I would be in support of that.
That's great. Brett's a little far now, but
I know.
Maybe he'll come home and visit. But Nick and I aren't too far away. And then Julie's just down there in Florida.
Okay.
That's far from everything. Far from everyone. It's beautiful out here, though. So at least I have the wilderness. Yeah. At least it's not super far and not pretty.
Yeah, I haven't heard. You're Idaho, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never heard anything bad about the landscape there. Actually, I have my old science teacher from freshman year in high school lives there, and he posts like the coolest pictures of the mountains. He's a mountain climber, and he's always like posting pictures from the peaks and all that. It's beautiful.
Yeah, there's so much to do. That's definitely, I've already identified some peaks that I want to hit before I have to, you know, potentially move away. So that's like one of the first things I did. I was like, I made a list of some of the peaks that I wanted to visit, but it's a little daunting because the state is absolutely massive, and some of the driving is a little slower because there are, you know, it's kind of like in a, not exactly, but it's kind of bisected by mountains. So pretty much no matter where you go, you know, that you have that influence of driving. So lots to do and see, but it's such a big state that you got to pack your calendar well in advance to get it all in. So I'm excited. Yeah. Unfortunately, the winter is coming up, so I won't be able to go as far, but we already picked up some skis at a local shop and we added it all up and we spent $75 on skis, boots, goggles, and I think there was maybe one other thing, but we like added it all up what it would have cost to buy all that stuff new. And it was like $1,400. So we kind of made out like bandits, and we're going to try out some skiing for the winter. So should be fun.
That should be fun. Yeah. That should be a lot of fun. Yeah. It sounds like you're doing it right, Brett, to be honest.
Trying to do a little bit of everything, but like I said earlier, that means I'm not great at any one thing. So, but yeah, and I'm sure I speak for us all, but that was a lot of insight that you gave us about carp fishing. So I appreciate you know, going into all that, because that's a whole different world that I haven't really dipped into at all. And there's a lot to unpack. So that was cool. I appreciate the description. And like Sue said, a video would be really cool for people to visualize that experience and the process.
Yeah, I can definitely do that. I'm just I'm just excited to be able to kind of tell people about it. I guess, like I said, I know, you know, common carp's not really the most respected fish, and it is commonly viewed as a trash fish. You know, it is what it is there, but it's nice to just be able to let people know about the sport of it. Like it is a lot of fun, and there's, you know, there is a community of people that do it here in the States. And really they are a fun fish to catch for sure. Is there anything else you might want to know? I know I've said a lot and I kind of feel bad.
Not at all. I think we should just have an update episode, especially after you move to Clemson. You can update us on what different kinds of fishing you pick up there, but carp fishing there. And really, Deanne, I think that you're on the forefront of what the U.S. really needs to do to tackle their carp problem. And, you know, there's not enough time left for us to get into that today, but, you know, what you're talking about in promoting fishing of carp, species that we need to manage in a lot of systems. I mean, you know, you're getting into some things that we all really need to start talking about and promoting.
Yeah.
Fisheries biologists. So I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. I know, I will say this. I think I remember Nick mentioning about carp not being too edible, but have you guys ever, any of y'all ever had common carp before? Like smoked carp?
I have not had common carp, but at the Midwest meeting most recently that I attended, where they had it in person in Springfield, Illinois, they had fried Asian carp. I don't know exactly which, you know, species it was, but it was in that sort of group. And it was delicious, like straight up. I really enjoyed it. And it was the first dish. Yeah, it was the first of the three that they served to run out. So it was, if it tastes anything like that, I'm sure I'd love it.
Yeah. Well, I know, I don't think you'll find fried common carp, but smoked common carp is actually pretty tasty, which I guess anything smoked is good. But if you really want to eat like fish, but not a carp, try smoking it at least, but just avoid the dark meat.
Okay.
Good to know.
It's a little oily.
We're not going to question it. They're just going to take your word for it.
Do you leave the skin on when you smoke it, or just flay it out just like if you were going to fry it and lay that on the
smoker? I've never smoked it myself. There's a fisheries store in Port Clinton, Ohio called Port Clinton Fish or Fisheries. I think it's Port Clinton Fish. And they sell like fillets, but the skin is on it. Like you can see the scaled side on the other side. I would pull that off. I pull it off at least. And yeah, other than that, I think it's delicious.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And just to briefly tie back in, I won't sort of get us started down this road because, you know, we've been talking for a while, but you know, when you say, or when you mention that, you know, it's not the most common fish to fish for, and in some systems it's non-native and everything, there are a lot of systems where, you know, people can lose sight of, you know, the prominence of the fishery or the status of the species in terms of a, you know, extremely common sport fish sort of outweighs the fact that it's not native to that system either. So I mean, there's plenty of like blue ribbon trout streams and you know, as I said earlier, like fly fishing and you know, trout fishing in general can sometimes be viewed as this greater than thou activity, but yeah, you know, there's plenty of blue ribbon areas where it's filled with non-native trout, so you're not alone, and it's not just, you know, carp that should get a bad rap based on physical appearance, or you know, obviously I'm not saying that they don't have negative effects in some places.
No,
but
yeah.
It's not just carp fishing, I guess is what I mean.
Yeah, I agree. I know that common carp can have, you know, negative impacts on an ecosystem, and you know, I'm not gonna be a stickler against removal if that's the case, but I will always promote, you know, fishing for them because they are a lot of fun to catch.
We really enjoyed hearing about it. Thanks so much, Deanne.
Yeah, thanks, Susan. Yeah, thanks, everyone.
I think people really like it. So I know I had a lot of fun talking about it.
Oh, so yeah, I enjoyed talking about carp fishing and hearing about your guys' fly fishing stuff. I think one of the things that fishing different ways brings is a respect for all fish species. So I noticed when I picked bass fishing back up again, and I shouldn't even really say bass fishing. I'll just say, like, you know, pan fishing, or I guess any cinchartid, but it's definitely given me a new respect for all species, because you know we all love fish, but you know you can't catch them all the same way. So using different methods of fishing is a good way to experience different fish.
Yeah, we've certainly highlighted a whole variety of different methods here, from fly fishing for trout to Sue now fly fishing for small long-eared sunfish, and me fishing for crappie and blue catfish and trying to snag for paddlefish, and Dion, you're going for carp. A whole variety of ways to get out there and learn more about fish and kind of relieve some stress and just maybe get away from work while still enjoying fish.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that pretty much wraps up this episode. We have a great lineup of episodes coming out. I know I have two episodes, one talking about mycobacteriosis with striped bass, and another one talking about a big bow fishing paper just put out by Jason Schooley and Dennis Garnecchia. Brett, do you have any episodes you want to plug?
I'm actually really excited. Speaking of trout and cutthroat trout and the West, really excited about my upcoming episode with Dr. Annika Walters. It'll be the first weekend in November. A fellow stream enthusiast, Sue, you should definitely mark your calendar for that one. And I had a great time with that episode.
Great. Can't wait to hear it.
And Sue, you are working on an episode coming out soon too, aren't you?
That's right. I'm working on episodes with Milton Tan and Mallory Hayes, a couple of folks that I met at Auburn, and we're going to get into fish diversity and explore this mystery of North American cyprinids with Milton. So those should come out in the new year.
And Julie had to sign off, but I'm sure she has some great episodes coming out. She puts out great episodes once a month along with all of us. But if you would like to get a hold of any of us, you can find us on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or send us an email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, and stickers available on our Teespring store. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 92nd episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember to get out and go fishing.